Yes, that's true. But that's only a small part of it. The era, it doesn't mean much to me. She made it mean something. Other vampires must experience this and survive it, the passing of 100 eras.
But they don't survive it, he said. The world would be choked with vampires if they survived it. How do you think I come to be the eldest here, or anywhere? He asked.
I thought about this, and then I ventured.
They die by violence? No, almost never. It isn't necessary. How many vampires do you think have the stamina for immortality? They have the most dismal notions of immortality to begin with, for in becoming immortal they want all the forms of their life to be fixed as they are and incorruptible. Carriages made in the same dependable fashion, clothing of the cut which suited their prime, men attired and speaking in the manner they have always understood and valued. When in fact, all things change except the vampire himself. Everything except the vampire is subject to constant corruption and distortion. Soon, with an inflexible mind, and often even with the most flexible mind, this immortality becomes a penitential sentence in a madhouse of figures and forms that are hopelessly unintelligible and without value. One evening, a vampire rises and realizes what he has feared, perhaps for decades, that he simply wants no more of life at any cost. That whatever style or fashion or shape of existence made immortality attractive to him has been swept off the face of the earth, and nothing remains to offer freedom from despair except the act of killing. And that vampire goes out to die. No one will find his remains. No one will know where he has gone. And often no one around him. Should he still seek the company of other vampires, no one will know that he is in despair. He will have ceased long ago to speak of himself, or of anything. He will vanish.
I sat back, impressed by the obvious truth of it, and yet at the same time everything in me revolted against that prospect. I became aware of the depth of my hope and my terror. How very different those feelings were from the alienation that he described, how very different from that awful, wasting despair. There was something outrageous and repulsive in that despair suddenly. I couldn't accept it.
But you wouldn't allow such a state of mind in yourself?
Look at you, I found myself answering. If there weren't one single work of art left in this world, and there are thousands, if there weren't a single natural beauty, if the world were reduced to one empty cell and one fragile candle, I can't help but see you studying that candle, absorbed in the flicker of its light, the change of its colors. How long could that sustain you? What possibilities would it create? Am I wrong? Am I such a crazed idealist?
No, he said. There was a brief smile on his lips, an evanescent flush of pleasure. But then he went on, simply, "But you feel an obligation to a world you love, because that world for you is still intact. It is conceivable your own sensitivity might become the instrument of madness. You speak of works of art and natural beauty. I wish I had the artist's power to bring alive for you the Venice of the 15th century. My master's palace there. The love I felt for him when I was a mortal boy, and the love he felt for me when he made me a vampire. Oh, if I could make those times come alive, for either you or me, for only an instant, what would that be worth? And what a sadness it is to me that time doesn't dim the memory of that period, that it becomes all the richer and more magical in light of the world I see today.
Love? I asked. There was love between you and the vampire who made you? I leaned forward.
Yes, he said. A love so strong he couldn't allow me to grow old and die. A love that waited patiently until I was strong enough to be born to darkness. Do you mean to tell me there was no bond of love between you and the vampire who made you?
None, I said quickly. I couldn't repress a bitter smile. He studied me.
Why, then, did he give you these powers? He asked.
I sat back.
You see these powers as a gift, I said. Of course you do. Forgive me, but it amazes me how in your complexity you are so profoundly simple.
I laughed.
Should I be insulted? He smiled. And his whole manner only confirmed me in what I just said. He seemed so innocent. I was only beginning to understand him.
No, not by me, I said, my pulse quickening as I looked at him. You're everything I dreamed of when I became a vampire.
You see these powers as a gift, I repeated it.
But tell me, do you now feel love for this vampire who gave you eternal life? Do you feel this now?
He appeared to be thinking, and then he said slowly, Why does this matter? But went on, I don't think I've been fortunate in feeling love for many people or many things. But yes, I love him. Perhaps I do not love him as you mean. It seems you confuse me rather effortlessly. You are a mystery. I do not need him, this vampire, any more.
I was gifted with eternal life, with heightened perception, and with a need to kill, I quickly explained, because the vampire who made me wanted the house I owned and my money.
Do you understand such a thing? I asked.
Ah, but there is so much else behind what I say. It makes itself known to me so slowly, so incompletely. You see, it's as if you cracked a door for me, and light is streaming from that door, and I'm yearning to get to it, to push it back, to enter the region you say exists beyond it. When, in fact, I don't believe it. The vampire who made me was everything that I truly believed evil to be. He was as dismal, as literal, as barren, as inevitably eternally disappointing as I believed evil had to be.
I know that now.
But you are something totally beyond that conception. Open the door for me. Push it back all the way. Tell me about this palace in Venice, this love affair with damnation. I want to understand it.
You trick yourself. The palace means nothing to you, he said. The doorway you see leads to me, now, to your coming to live with me as I am. I am evil, with infinite gradations and without guilt.
Yes, exactly, I murmured.
And this makes you unhappy, he said. You who came to me in my cell and said there was only one sin left, the willful taking of an innocent human life.
Yes, I said.
How you must have been laughing at me.
I never laughed at you, he said. I cannot afford to laugh at you.
It is through you that I can save myself from the despair which I've described to you as our death. It is through you that I must make my link with this 19th century, and come to understand it in a way that will revitalize me, which I so desperately need. It is for you that I've been waiting at the Théâtre des Vampires. If I knew a mortal of that sensitivity, that pain, that focus, I would make him a vampire in an instant. But such can rarely be done. No, I've had to wait and watch for you. And now I'll fight for you. Do you see how ruthless I am in love? Is this what you meant by love?
Oh, but you'd be making a terrible mistake, I said, looking him in the eyes. His words were only slowly sinking in. Never had I felt my all-consuming frustration to be so clear. I could not conceivably satisfy him. I could not satisfy Claudia. I'd never been able to satisfy Lestat. And my own mortal brother, Paul. How dismally, mortally I had disappointed him.
No, I must make contact with the age, he said to me calmly. and I can do this through you. Not to learn things from you which I can see in a moment in an art gallery, or read in an hour in the thickest books. You are the spirit. You are the heart, he persisted. No, no, I threw up my hands. I was on the point of a bitter, hysterical laughter. Don't you see? I'm not the spirit of any age. I'm at odds with everything and always have been. I have never belonged anywhere with anyone at any time. It was too painful, too perfectly true. But his face only brightened with an irresistible smile. He seemed on the verge of laughing at me, and then his shoulders began to move with this laughter. But, Louis, he said softly, this is the very spirit of your age. Don't you see that? Everyone else feels as you feel. Your fall from grace and faith has been the fall of a century. I was so stunned by this that for a long time I sat there staring into the fire. It had all but consumed the wood and was a wasteland of smouldering ash, a grey and red landscape that would have collapsed at the touch of the poker. Yet it was very warm, and still gave off powerful light. I saw my life in complete perspective. "And the vampires of the théâtre?" I asked softly. "They reflect the age in cynicism which cannot comprehend the death of possibilities. Fatuous, sophisticated indulgence in the parody of the miraculous, decadence whose last refuge is self-ridicule, a mannered helplessness. You saw them. You've known them all your life. You reflect your age differently. You reflect its broken heart. This is unhappiness. Unhappiness you don't begin to understand. I don't doubt it. Tell me what you feel now, what makes you unhappy. Tell me why, for a period of 7 days, you haven't come to me, though you were burning to come. Tell me what holds you still to Claudia and the other woman." I shook my head. "You don't know what you ask. You see, it was immensely difficult for me to perform the act of making Madeleine into a vampire. I broke a promise to myself that I would never do this, that my own loneliness would never drive me to do it. I don't see our life as powers and gifts. I see it as a curse. I haven't the courage to die. But to make another vampire, to bring this suffering on another, and to condemn to death all those men and women whom that vampire must subsequently kill. I broke a grave promise, and in so doing, but if it's any consolation to you, surely you realize I had a hand in it. That I did it to be free of Claudia, to be free to come to you. Yes, I realize that. But the ultimate responsibility lies with me," I said. "No, I mean directly. I made you do it. I was near you the night you did it. I exerted my strongest power to persuade you to do it. Didn't you know this?" "No." I bowed my head. "I would have made this woman a vampire," he said softly. "But I thought it best you have a hand in it. Otherwise you would not give Claudia up. You must know you wanted it." "I loathe what I did," I said.
"Then loathe me, not yourself."
"No, you don't understand. You nearly destroyed the thing you value in me when this happened. I resisted you with all my power when I didn't even know it was your force which was working on me. Something nearly died in me. Passion nearly died in me. I was all but destroyed when Madeleine was created."
"But that thing is no longer dead, that passion, that humanity, whatever you wish to name it. If it were not alive, there wouldn't be tears in your eyes now. There wouldn't be rage in your voice," he said. For a moment, I couldn't answer. I only nodded. Then I struggled to speak again.
"You must never force me to do something against my will. You must never exert such power," I stammered.
"No," he said at once, "I must not. My power stops somewhere inside you, at some threshold. There I am powerless. However, this creation of Madeleine is done. You are free.
And you are satisfied, I said, gaining control of myself. I don't mean to be harsh. You have me. I love you. But I'm mystified.
You're satisfied?
How could I not be? He asked. I am satisfied, of course.
I stood up and went to the window. The last embers were dying. The light came from the grey sky. I heard Armand follow me to the window ledge. I could feel him beside me now, my eyes growing more and more accustomed to the luminosity of the sky, so that now I could see his profile and his eye on the falling rain. The sound of the rain was everywhere and different, flowing in the gutter along the roof, tapping the shingles, falling softly through the shimmering layers of tree branches, splattering on the sloped stone sill in front of my hands. A soft intermingling of sounds that drenched and colored all of the night.
"Do you forgive me for forcing you with the woman?" he asked.
"You don't need my forgiveness."
"You need it," he said. "Therefore I need it." His face was, as always, utterly calm.
"Will she care for Claudia? Will she endure?" I asked.
"She is perfect. Mad, but for these days that is perfect. She will care for Claudia. She has never lived a moment of life alone. It is natural to her that she be devoted to her companions. She need not have particular reasons for loving Claudia. Yet, in addition to her needs, she does have particular reasons. Claudia's beautiful surface, Claudia's quiet, Claudia's dominance and control, they are perfect together. But I think that as soon as possible they should leave Paris.
Why?
You know why. Because Santiago and the other vampires watch them with suspicion. All the vampires have seen Madeleine. They fear her because she knows about them and they don't know her. They don't let others alone who know about them.
And the boy Denis? What do you plan to do with him?
He's dead, he answered.
I was astonished, both at his words and his calm.
"You killed him?" I gasped. He nodded, and said nothing, but his large, dark eyes seemed entranced with me, with the emotion, the shock I didn't try to conceal. His soft, subtle smile seemed to draw me close to him. His hand closed over mine on the wet windowsill, and I felt my body turning to face him, drawing nearer to him as though I were being moved not by myself but by him.
"It was best," he conceded to me gently, and then said, "We must go now," and he glanced at the street below.
"Armand," I said, "I can't."
"Louis, come after me," he whispered,
and then on the ledge he stopped.
"Even if you were to fall on the cobblestones there," he said, "you would only be hurt for a while. You would heal so rapidly and so perfectly that in days you would show no sign of it, your bones healing as your skin heals. So let this knowledge free you to do what you can so easily do already. Climb down. Now."
"What can kill me?" I asked. Again he stopped.
"The destruction of your remains," he said. "Don't you know this?
Fire, dismemberment, the heat of the sun.
Nothing else.
You can be scarred, yes, but you are resilient. You are immortal." I was looking down through the quiet silver rain into darkness. Then a light flickered beneath the shifting tree limbs, and the pale beams of the light made the street appear. Wet cobblestones, the iron hook of the carriage house bell, the vines clinging to the top of the wall. The huge black hulk of a carriage brushed the vines, and then the light grew weak. The street went from yellow to silver and vanished altogether, as if the dark trees had swallowed it up. Or rather, as if it had all been subtracted from the dark. I felt dizzy. I felt the building move. Armand was seated on the windowsill looking down at me.
"Louis, come with me tonight," he whispered suddenly, with an urgent inflection.
"No," I said gently. "It's too soon. I can't leave them yet." I watched him turn away and look at the dark sky. He appeared to sigh, but I didn't hear it. I felt his hand close on mine on the windowsill.
"Very well," he said.
"A little more time," I said. And he nodded and patted my hand as if to say it was all right. Then he swung his legs over and disappeared. For only a moment I hesitated, mocked by the pounding of my heart. But then I climbed over the sill and commenced to hurry after him, never daring to look down. It was very near dawn when I put my key into the lock of the hotel. The gaslight flared along the walls, and Madeleine, her needle and thread in her hands, had fallen asleep by the grate. Claudia stood still, looking at me from among the ferns at the window, in shadow. She had her hairbrush in her hands. Her hair was gleaming. I stood there absorbing some shock, as if all the sensual pleasures and confusions of these rooms were passing over me like waves, and my body were being permeated with these things, so different from the spell of Armand and the tower room where we'd been. There was something comforting here, and it was disturbing. I was looking for my chair. I was sitting in it with my hands on my temples. And then I felt Claudia near me, and I felt her lips against my forehead.
"You've been with Armand," she said. "You want to go with him."
I looked up at her. How soft and beautiful her face was. And suddenly, so much mine. I felt no compunction in yielding to my urge to touch her cheeks, to lightly touch her eyelids, familiarities, liberties I hadn't taken with her since the night of our quarrel. "I'll see you again. Not here, in other places. Always I'll know where you are," I said. She put her arms around my neck. She held me tight, and I closed my eyes and buried my face in her hair. I was covering her neck with my kisses. I had hold of her round, firm little arms. I was kissing them, kissing the soft indentation of the flesh in the crooks of her arms, her wrists, her open palms. I felt her fingers stroking my hair, my face.
"Whatever you wish," she vowed, "whatever you wish."
"Are you happy? Do you have what you want?" I begged her.
"Yes, Louis."
She held me against her dress, her fingers clasping the back of my neck.
"I have all that I want. But do you truly know what you want?"
She was lifting my face, so I had to look into her eyes.
"It's you I fear for, you who might be making the mistake. Why don't you leave Paris with us?" she said suddenly. "We have the world. Come with us."
"No." I drew back from her. "You want it to be as it was with Lestat. It can't be that way again, ever. It won't be."
"It will be something new and different with Madeleine. I don't ask for that again. It was I who put an end to that," she said. "But do you truly understand what you are choosing in Armand?"
I turned away from her. There was something stubborn and mysterious in her dislike of him, in her failure to understand him. She would say again that he wished her death, which I did not believe. She didn't realize what I realized. He could not want her death because I didn't want it. But how could I explain this to her without sounding pompous and blind in my love of him? "It's meant to be. It's almost that sort of direction," I said, as if it were just coming clear to me under the pressure of her doubts. "He alone can give me the strength to be what I am. I can't continue to live divided and consumed with misery. Either I go with him or I die," I said. "And it's something else which is irrational and unexplainable and which satisfies only me.
"Which is?" she asked.
"That I love him," I said.
"No doubt you do," she mused. "But then you could love even me."
"Claudia,
Claudia!" I held her close to me and felt her weight on my knee. She drew up close to my chest. "I only hope that when you have need of me you can find me," she whispered, "that I can get back to you. I've hurt you so often. I've caused you so much pain."
Her words trailed off. She was resting still against me. I felt her weight, thinking, in a little while I won't have her any more. I want now simply to hold her. There has always been such pleasure in that simple thing, her weight against me, this hand resting against my neck. It seemed a lamp died somewhere, that from the cool, damp air that much light was suddenly, soundlessly subtracted. I was sitting on the verge of dream. Had I been mortal, I would have been content to sleep there. And in that drowsy, comfortable state I had a strange, habitual mortal feeling that the sun would wake me gently later, and I would have that rich, habitual vision of the ferns in the sunshine and the sunshine in the droplets of rain. I indulged that feeling. I half closed my eyes. Often afterwards I tried to remember those moments, tried over and over to recall just what it was in those rooms as we rested there that began to disturb me, should have disturbed me, how, being off my guard, I was somehow insensible to the subtle changes which must have been taking place there. Long after, bruised and robbed and embittered beyond my wildest dreams, I sifted through those moments, those drowsy, quiet, early-hour moments when the clock ticked almost imperceptibly on the mantelpiece, and the sky grew paler and paler, and all I could remember, despite the desperation with which I lengthened and fixed that time, in which I held out my hands to stop the clock, all I could remember was the soft changing of light. On guard, I would never have let it pass. Deluded with larger concerns, I made no note of it. A lamp gone out. A candle extinguished by the shiver of its own hot pool of wax. My eyes half shut, I had the sense then of impending darkness, of being shut up in darkness. And then I opened my eyes, not thinking of lamps or candles. And it was too late. I remember standing upright, Claudia's hand slipping on my arm, and a vision of a host of black-dressed men and women moving through the rooms, their garments seeming to garner light from every gilt edge or lacquered surface, seeming to drain all light away. I shouted out against them, shouted for Madeline, saw her wake with a start, terrified, fledgling, clinging to the arm of the couch, then down on her knees as they reached out for her. There was Santiago and Celeste coming towards us, and behind them Estelle and others whose names I didn't know, filling the mirrors and crowding together to make walls of shifting, menacing shadow. I was shouting to Claudia to run, having pulled back the door. I was shoving her through it and then was stretched across it, kicking out at Santiago as he came. That weak, defensive position I'd held against him in the Latin Quarter was nothing compared to my strength now. I was too flawed, perhaps, to ever fight with conviction for my own protection. But the instinct to protect Madeline and Claudia was overpowering. I remember kicking Santiago backwards, and then striking out at that powerful, beautiful Celeste, who sought to get by me. Claudia's feet sounded on the distant marble stairway. Celeste was reeling, clawing at me, catching hold of me and scratching my face so the blood ran down over my collar. I could see it blazing in the corner of my eye. I was on Santiago now, turning with him, aware of the awful strength of the arms that held me, the hands that sought to get a hold on my throat. "Fight them, Madeline!" I was shouting to her. But all I could hear was her sobbing. Then I saw her in the whirl,
a fixed, frightened thing surrounded by other vampires. They were laughing that hollow vampire laughter which is like tinsel or silver bells. Santiago was clutching at his face. My teeth had drawn blood there. I struck at his chest, at his head, the pain searing through my arm, something enclosing my chest like two arms which I shook off, hearing the crash of broken glass behind me. But something else, someone else had hold of my arm with two arms and was pulling me with tenacious strength. I don't remember weakening. I don't remember any turning point when anyone's strength overcame my own. I remember simply being outnumbered. Hopelessly, by sheer numbers and persistence, I was stilled, surrounded, and forced out of the rooms. In a press of vampires, I was being forced along the passageway, and then I was falling down the steps, free for a moment before the narrow back doors of the hotel, only to be surrounded again and held tight. I could see Celeste's face very near me, and if I could have, I would have wounded her with my teeth. I was bleeding badly, and one of my wrists was held so tightly that there was no feeling in that hand. Madeleine was next to me, sobbing still, and all of us were pressed into a carriage. Over and over I was struck, and still I did not lose consciousness. I remember clinging tenaciously to consciousness, feeling these blows on the back of my head, feeling the back of my head wet with blood that trickled down my neck as I lay on the carriage floor. I was thinking only, I can feel the carriage moving. I am alive. I am conscious. And as soon as we were dragged into the Théâtre des Vampires, I was crying out for Armand. I was let go, only to stagger on the cellar steps, the horde of them behind me and in front of me, pushing me with menacing hands. At one point I got hold of Celeste, and she screamed and someone struck me from behind. And then I saw Lestat. The blow that was more crippling than any blow. Lestat standing there in the center of the ballroom, erect, his grey eyes sharp and focused, his mouth lengthening in a cunning smile. Impeccably dressed he was, as always, and as splendid in his rich black cloak and fine linen. But those scars still scored every inch of his white flesh. And how they distorted the taut, handsome face, the fine, hard threads cutting the delicate skin above his lip, the lids of his eyes, the smooth rise of his forehead. And the eyes. They burned with a silent rage that seemed infused with vanity, an awful, relentless vanity that said, "See what I am." "This is the one," said Santiago, thrusting me forward. But Lestat turned sharply to him and said in a harsh, low voice, "I told you I wanted Claudia, the child. She was the one." And now I saw his head moving involuntarily with his outburst, and his hand reaching out as if for the arm of a chair, only to close as he drew himself up again, eyes to me. "Lestat," I began, seeing now the few straws left to me, "you are alive. You have your life. Tell them how you treated us."
"No," he shook his head furiously. "You come back to me, Louis," he said.
For a moment I could not believe my ears. Some saner, more desperate part of me said, "Reason with him," even as the sinister laughter erupted from my lips. "Are you mad?"
"I'll give you back your life," he said,
his eyelids quivering with the stress of his words, his chest heaving, that hand going out again and closing impotently in the dark.
"You promised me," he said to Santiago, "I could take him back with me to New Orleans."
And then, as he looked from one to the other of them as they surrounded us, his breath became frantic, and he burst out,
"Claudia, where is she? She's the one who did it to me, I told you."
"By and by," said Santiago. And when he reached out for Lestat, Lestat drew back and almost lost his balance. He had found the chair arm he needed, and stood holding fast to it, his eyes closed, regaining his control.
"But he helped her, aided her," said Santiago,
drawing nearer to him, Lestat looked up.
No, he said. Louis, you must come back to me. There's something I must tell you about that night in the swamp.
But then he stopped and looked about again, as though he were caged, wounded, desperate.
Listen to me, Lestat, I began now. You let her go, you free her, and I'll return to you, I said, the words sounding hollow, metallic. I tried to take a step towards him, to make my eyes hard and unreadable, to feel my power emanating from them like two beams of light. He was looking at me, studying me, struggling all the while against his own fragility, and Celeste had her hand on my wrist. "You must tell them," I went on, "how you treated us, that we didn't know the laws, that she didn't know of other vampires," I said. And I was thinking steadily as that mechanical voice came out of me, "Armand must return tonight. Armand must come back. He will stop this. He won't let it go on." There was a sound then of something dragging across the floor. I could hear Madeleine's exhausted crying. I looked around and saw her in a chair, and when she saw my eyes on her, her terror seemed to increase. She tried to rise, but they stopped her. "Lestat," I said, "what do you want of me? I'll give it to you."
And then I saw the thing that was making the noise, and Lestat had seen it too. It was a coffin with large iron locks on it that was being dragged into the room. I understood at once.
"Where is Armand?" I said desperately. "She did it to me, Louis. She did it to me. You didn't." "She has to die," said Lestat, his voice becoming thin, rasping as if it were an effort for him to speak. "Get that thing away from here. He's coming home with me," he said furiously to Santiago. And Santiago only laughed, and Celeste laughed, and the laughter seemed to infect them all.
"You promised me," said Lestat to them. "I promised you nothing," said Santiago.
"They've made a fool of you," I said to him bitterly, as they were opening the coffin. "A fool of you? You must reach Armand. Armand is the leader here," I burst out. But he didn't seem to understand. What happened then was desperate and clouded and miserable. My kicking at them, struggling to free my arms, raging against them that Armand would stop what they were doing, that they dare not hurt Claudia. Yet they forced me down into the coffin, my frantic efforts serving no purpose against them except to take my mind off the sound of Madeleine's cries, her awful, wailing cries, and the fear that at any moment Claudia's cries might be added to them. I remember rising against the crushing lid, holding it at bay for an instant before it was forced shut on me, and the locks were being shut with the grinding of metal and keys. Words of long ago came back to me. A strident and smiling Lestat in that faraway, trouble-free place where the three of us had quarrelled together. "A starving child is a frightful sight. A starving vampire even worse. They'd hear her screams in Paris." And my wet and trembling body went limp in the suffocating coffin, and I said, "Armand will not let it happen. There isn't a place secure enough for them to place us." The coffin was lifted. There was the scraping of boots, the swinging from side to side, my arms braced against the sides of the box, my eyes shut, perhaps, for a moment. I was uncertain. I told myself not to reach out for the sides, not to feel the thin margin of air between my face and the lid. And I felt the coffin swing and tilt as their steps found the stairs. Vainly, I tried to make out Madeleine's cries, for it seemed that she was crying for Claudia, calling out to her as if she could help us all. "Call for Armand. He must come home this night," I thought desperately. And only the thought of the awful humiliation of hearing my own cry closed in with me, flooding my ears, yet locked in with me, prevented me from calling out. But another thought had come over me even as I phrased those words. What if he did not come? What if somewhere in that mansion he had a coffin hidden to which he returned? And then it seemed my body broke suddenly, without warning, from the control of my mind, and I flailed at the wood around me, struggling to turn over and pit the strength of my back against the coffin lid. Yet I could not. It was too close, and my head fell back on the boards, and the sweat poured down my back and sides. Madeleine's cries were gone. All I heard were the boots and my own breathing. Then tomorrow night he will come. Yes, tomorrow night, and they will tell him, and he will find us and release us. The coffin swayed. The smell of water filled my nostrils, its coolness palpable through the close heat of the coffin, and then with the smell of the water was the smell of the deep earth. The coffin was set down roughly, and my limbs ached, and I rubbed the backs of my arms with my hands, struggling not to touch the coffin lid, not to sense how close it was, afraid of my own fear rising to panic, to terror. I thought they would leave me now, but they did not. They were near at hand and busy, and another odor came to my nostrils, which was raw and not known to me. But then, as I lay very still, I realized they were laying bricks and that the odor came from the mortar. Slowly, carefully, I brought my hand up to wipe my face. All right, then. Tomorrow night, I reasoned with myself, even as my shoulders seemed to grow large against the coffin walls. All right, then. Tomorrow night he will come. And until then, this is merely the confines of my own coffin. The price I've paid for all of this, night after night after night. But the tears were welling in my eyes, and I could see myself flailing again at the wood, and my head was turning from side to side, my mind rushing on to tomorrow, and the night after, and the night after that. And then, as if to distract myself from this madness, I thought of Claudia, only to feel her arms around me in the dim light of those rooms in the Hotel Saint Gabriel, only to see the curve of her cheek in the light, the soft, languid flutter of her eyelashes, the silky touch of her lip. My body stiffened. My feet kicked at the boards. The sound of the bricks was gone, and the muffled steps were gone. And I cried out for her, Claudia, until my neck was twisted with pain as I tossed, and my nails had dug into my palms. And slowly, like an icy stream, the paralysis of sleep came over me. I tried to call out to Armand, foolishly, desperately, only dimly aware as my lids grew heavy and my hands lay limp, that the sleep was on him too somewhere, that he lay still in his resting place. One last time I struggled. My eyes saw the dark, my hands felt the wood. But I was weak, and then there was nothing. I awoke to a voice. It was distant but distinct. It said my name twice. For an instant I didn't know where I was. I'd been dreaming something desperate which was threatening to vanish completely without the slightest clue to what it had been, and something terrible which I was eager, willing to let go. Then I opened my eyes and felt the top of the coffin. I knew where I was at the same instant that, mercifully, I knew it was Armand who was calling me. I answered him, but my voice was locked in with me, and it was deafening. In a moment of terror, I thought, he's searching for me, and I can't tell him that I am here. But then I heard him speaking to me, telling me not to be afraid. And I heard a loud noise, and another, and there was a cracking sound, and then the thunderous falling of the bricks. It seemed several of them struck the coffin, and then I heard them lifted off. One by one, it sounded as though he were pulling off the locks by the nails. The hard wood of the top creaked. A pinpoint of light sparkled before my eyes. I drew breath from it and felt the sweat break out on my face. The lid creaked open, and for an instant I was blinded. Then I was sitting up, seeing the bright light of a lamp through my fingers.
Hurry, he said to me. Don't make a sound. But where are we going? I asked. I could see a passage of rough bricks stretching out from the doorway he'd broken down, and all along that passage were doors which were sealed as this door had been. I had a vision at once of coffins behind those bricks, of vampires starved and decayed there. But Armand was pulling me up, telling me again to make no sound. We were creeping along the passage.
He stopped at a wooden door, and then he extinguished the lamp.
It was completely black for an instant until the seam of light beneath the door brightened. He opened the door so gently the hinges did not make a sound. I could hear my own breathing now, and I tried to stop it. We were entering that lower passageway which led to his cell. But as I raced along behind him, I became aware of one awful truth. He was rescuing me, but me alone. I put out my hand to stop him, but he only pulled me after him. Only when we stood in the alleyway beside the Théâtre des Vampires was I able to make him stop, and even then he was on the verge of going on. He began shaking his head even before I spoke.
"I can't save her," he said.
"You don't honestly expect me to leave without her? They have her in there." I was horrified. "Armand, you must save her. You have no choice."
"Why do you say this?" he answered. "I don't have the power. You must understand. They'll rise against me. There is no reason why they should not. Louis, I tell you, I cannot save her. I will only risk losing you. You can't go back."
I refused to admit this could be true. I had no hope other than Armand. But I can truthfully say that I was beyond being afraid. I knew only that I had to get Claudia back or die in the effort. It was really very simple, not a matter of courage at all. And I knew also, could tell in everything about Armand's passivity, the manner in which he spoke, that he would follow me if I returned, that he would not try to prevent me. I was right. I was rushing back into the passage, and he was just behind me, heading for the stairway to the ballroom. I could hear the other vampires. I could hear all manner of sounds, the Paris traffic, what sounded very much like a congregation in the vault of the theatre above. And then, as I reached the top of the steps, I saw Celeste in the door of the ballroom. She held one of those stage masks in her hand. She was merely looking at me. She did not appear alarmed. In fact, she appeared strangely indifferent. If she had rushed at me, if she had sounded a general alarm, these things I could have understood, but she did nothing. She stepped backwards into the ballroom. She turned, seeming to enjoy the subtle movement of her skirts, seeming to turn for the love of making her skirts flare out, and she drifted in a widening circle to the center of the room. She put the mask to her face and said softly behind the painted skull, "Lestat, it is your friend Louis come calling. Look sharp, Lestat." She dropped the mask, and there was a ripple of laughter from somewhere. I saw they were all about the room, shadowy things, seated here and there, standing together, and Lestat, in an armchair, sat with his shoulders hunched and his face turned away from me. It seemed he was working something with his hands, something I couldn't see, and slowly he looked up, his full yellow hair falling into his eyes. There was fear in them. It was undeniable. Now he was looking at Armand, and Armand was moving silently through the room with slow, steady steps, and all of the vampires moved back away from him, watching him.
"Bonsoir, monsieur,"
Celeste bowed to him as he passed her, that mask in her hand like a scepter. He did not look at her in particular. He looked down at Lestat.
"Are you satisfied?" he asked him.
Lestat's grey eyes seemed to regard Armand with wonder, and his lips struggled to form a word. I could see that his eyes were filling with tears.
"Yes," he whispered now,
his hand struggling with the thing he concealed beneath his black cloak. But then he looked at me, and the tears spilled down his face.
"Louis," he said, his voice deep and rich now with what seemed an unbearable struggle, "please, you must listen to me. You must come back." And then, bowing his head, he grimaced with shame. Santiago was laughing somewhere. Armand was saying softly to Lestat that he must get out, leave Paris. He was outcast. And Lestat sat there with his eyes closed, his face transfigured with his pain. It seemed the double of Lestat, some wounded, feeling creature I'd never known. "Please," he said, the voice eloquent and gentle as he implored me. "I can't talk to you here. I can't make you understand. You'll come with me for only a little while, until I am myself again." "This is madness," I said, my hands rising suddenly to my temples. "Where is she? Where is she?" I looked about me at their still, passive faces, those inscrutable smiles.
"Lestat," I turned him now, grabbing at the black wool of his lapels.
And then I saw the thing in his hands. I knew what it was. In an instant I'd ripped it from him and was staring at it, at the fragile silken thing that it was. Claudia's yellow dress. His hand rose to his lips. His face turned away. And the soft, subdued sobs broke from him as he sat back while I stared at him, while I stared at the dress.
My fingers moved slowly over the tears in it, the stains of blood, my hands closing, trembling as I crushed it against my chest.
For a long moment it seemed I simply stood there. Time had no bearing upon me nor upon those shifting vampires, with their light, ethereal laughter filling my ears. I remember thinking that I wanted to put my hands over my ears, but I wouldn't let go of the dress, couldn't stop trying to make it so small that it was hidden within my hands. I remember a row of candles burning, an uneven row coming to light one by one against the painted walls. A door stood open to the rain, and all the candles spluttered and blew on the wind as if the flames were being lifted from the wicks. But they clung to the wicks and were all right. I knew that Claudia was through the doorway. The candles moved. The vampires had hold of them. Santiago had a candle and was bowing to me and gesturing for me to pass through the door. I was barely aware of him. I didn't care about him or the others at all. Something in me said, if you care about them, you will go mad. And they don't matter, really. She matters. Where is she? Find her. And their laughter was remote, and it seemed to have a color and a shape, but to be part of nothing. Then I saw something through the open doorway, which was something I'd seen before, a long time ago. No one knew of this thing I'd seen years before except myself. No, Lestat knew. But it didn't matter. He wouldn't know now, or understand, that he and I had seen this thing, standing at the door of that brick kitchen in the Rue Royale, two wet, shriveled things that had been alive, mother and daughter in one another's arms, the murdered pair on the kitchen floor. But these two, lying under the gentle rain, were Madeleine and Claudia. And Madeleine's lovely red hair mingled with the gold of Claudia's hair, which stirred and glistened in the wind that sucked through the open doorway. Only that which was living had been burnt away. Not the hair, not the long, empty velvet dress, not the small, blood-stained chemise with its eyelets of white lace. And the blackened, burnt and drawn thing that was Madeleine still bore the stamp of her living face, and the hand that clutched at the child was whole like a mummy's hand. But the child, the ancient one, my Claudia, was ashes. A cry rose in me, a consuming cry that came from the bowels of my being, rising up like the wind in that narrow place, the wind that swirled the rain teeming on those ashes, beating at the trace of a tiny hand against the bricks, that golden hair lifting, those loose strands rising, flying upwards. And a blow struck me even as I cried out, and I had hold of something that I believed to be Santiago, and I was pounding against him, destroying him, twisting that grinning white face around with hands from which he couldn't free himself, hands against which he railed, crying out, his cries mingling with my cries, his boots coming down into those ashes, as I threw him backwards away from them, my own eyes blinded with the rain, with my tears, until he lay back away from me, and I was reaching out for him even as he held out his hand. And the one I was struggling against was Armand. Armand, who was forcing me out of the tiny graveyard, into the whirling colours of the ballroom, the cries, the mingling voices, that searing, silver laughter. And Lestat was calling out, "Louis, wait for me! Louis, I must talk to you!" I could see Armand's rich, brown eye close to mine, and I felt weak all over, and vaguely aware that Madeline and Claudia were dead, his voice saying softly, perhaps soundlessly, "I could not prevent it. I could not prevent it." And they were dead. Simply dead. And I was losing consciousness. Santiago was near them, somewhere, there, where they were still. That hair lifted on the wind, swept across those bricks, unraveling locks. But I was losing consciousness. I could not gather their bodies up with me, could not take them out. Armand had his arm around my back, his hand under my arm, and he was all but carrying me through some hollow, wooden, echoing place, and the smells of the street were rising, the fresh smell of the horses and the leather, and there were the gleaming carriages stopped there. And I could see myself clearly running down the Boulevard des Capucines with a small coffin under my arm, and the people making way for me, and dozens of people rising around the crowded tables of the open café, and a man lifting his arm. It seemed I stumbled then, the Louis whom Armand held in his arm, and again I saw his brown eyes looking at me, and felt that drowsiness, that sinking. And yet I walked, I moved. I saw the gleam of my own boots on the pavement. "Is he mad that he says these things to me?" I was asking of Lestat, my voice shrill and angry, even the sound of it giving me some comfort. I was laughing, laughing loudly. "He's stark raving mad to speak to me in this manner? Did you hear him?" I demanded. And Armand's eye said, "Sleep." I wanted to say something about Madeline and Claudia, that we could not leave them there. And I felt that cry again rising inside of me, that cry that pushed everything else out of its way, my teeth clenched to keep it in, because it was so loud and so full it would destroy me if I let it go. And then I conceived of everything too clearly. We were walking now, a belligerent, blind sort of walking that men do when they are wildly drunk and filled with hatred for others, while at the same time they feel invincible. I was walking in such a manner through New Orleans the night I'd first encountered Lestat, that drunken walking which is a battering against things, which is miraculously sure-footed and finds its path. I saw a drunken man's hands fumbling miraculously with a match, flame touched to the pipe, the smoke drawn in. I was standing at a café window. The man was drawing on his pipe. He was not at all drunk. Armand stood beside me waiting, and we were in the crowded Boulevard des Capucines. Or was it the Boulevard du Temple? I wasn't sure. I was outraged that their bodies remained there in that vile place. I saw Santiago's foot touching the blackened, burned thing that had been my child. I was crying out through clenched teeth, and the man had risen from his table and steam spread out on the glass in front of his face. "Get away from me," I was saying to Armand. "Damn you into hell, don't come near me. I warn you, don't come near me."
I was walking away from him up the boulevard, and I could see a man and a woman stepping aside for me, the man with his arm out to protect the woman. Then I was running. People saw me running. I wondered how it appeared to them, what wild white thing they saw that moved to